Well, I'll start with a very mathematical motivation for this talk. So there's this very well-known beautiful result due to Gell-Sollinger that, you know, if I have 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix and it has certain entries from certain ring, so the one we've shown on slides over here, right, it's like 1 over 2 to the n and then a plus bi plus c root 2 plus di root 2 where a, b, c, and d are integers, it turns out that any such matrix can be represented as a Clifford plus T circuit, I mean, subject to some determinant constraints in small dimensions. Right, and later this results were generalized to some other examples of rings. And kind of, I think it's just mathematically beautiful, right, to be able to just look at the matrix and say, oh, you know, I can find a circuit that exactly represents its matrix. And there are some practical applications for that, in particular for one qubit, it results in very efficient approximation algorithms for compiling arbitrary rotations. So the kind of question I want to ask, well, you know, it tells us that unitary must be implementable by Clifford plus T gate set, but what if you just want to ask the same question, but for unitary U being a Clifford, right? And kind of one kind of little weakness of all these proofs, they're constructive, they actually provide you a circuit, but what happens there, even though you can kind of put in the unitary that is Clifford into the proof machinery and you get a Clifford plus T circuit that has like non-trivial number of T gates. So what I would like is kind of similar result, but just that directly lets me identify Clifford unitaries. So to give you some background, right? I mean, luckily you already seen quite a bit about polymatrices today, and you know Clifford unitaries are the ones that map polymatrices to plus minus polymatrices. They're generated by C naught, so any Clifford unitary can be written as a product of C naught S, and see, here I use this thing called like phase-adjusted Hadamard. So it's normal Hadamard up to global phase, but that's my way of getting rid of a root 2. So I can actually have kind of simpler number series structures over here, right? So it's my phase-adjusted Hadamard. It's like 1 plus I sort of plays the role of the root 2. And you know, that famous T gate is the diagonal gate with e to the I power 4 on the diagonal. Okay, so why, you know, why is the separation of Clifford versus non-Clifford is relevant? Just kind of zoom out a little bit. Well, there's kind of mounting evidence that we need fault tolerance to solve some useful problems in quantum computers, and we can think of non-Clifford resources as fuel of our computation, right? So they're consumed, in a way, we can think of them is actually a very convenient lower bound tool because essentially, like, no matter what you do, if you have quantum algorithms that use a certain number of T and CC states, you have to produce them and you have to consume them. So it's kind of set some time on your computation. And it also allows for very robust comparison between different platforms. You can kind of just figure out like how good your platform at producing T and CC states and give you some rough idea about the performance of the platform, right? So with this motivation, right, we kind of want to go and better understand distinction between Clifford unitaries and non-Clifford unitaries, and kind of this talk offers a kind of slightly new perspective, or maybe slightly forgotten perspective from 1997, right? And so kind of what is the common ways of thinking about, like, well, is it a unitary or a Clifford unitary or not, right? The most simple way is just take generators of poly groups, conjugate by unitary, check if you got poly back, right? It's, you know, it's kind of not very computationally efficient, but it's kind of okay. But, I mean, there's more efficient algorithms, right? There's fast, there exists a fast algorithm for checking if the unitary is Clifford or not that is kind of almost optimal because performance is very close to just time needed to read out the entries. Right, but kind of the question that I'm asking still remains is like, well, can I just like look at the metrics entries and say, oh, this is a Clifford? Just as simple as that. And it turns out the first kind of special case of the answer to this question is, well, you can do that, you just need to change the basis, right? So it turns out the special case of the result that I'm going to talk about today is the following. Take your unit tree U with entries, say, in this zi 1/2, which is like a plus be over 2 to the n, where a and b are integers, right? And such a matrix is a Clifford unit tree if and only if I basically just change the basis of that unit tree into this non-orthogonal basis made essential of like kind of rescaled 0 and a plus state. And if that matrix now just has all integer entries as integer, like a Gaussian integer, then it turns out to be a Clifford, right? And you might ask, where, what happened with square root of 2 in my Cliffords? Well, that's because I use phase-adjusted Hadamard, right? I got rid of square root of 2, so it kind of makes it possible for me to make this very simple statement. And you know, it turns out you can do a little bit better. You also even just can not restrict yourself to range, but you can just use a kind of Gaussian rationals, right, and allow A and B to be rationals. And then any unitary with entries in QI is a Clifford if and only if this basis change version of it has integer entries. Okay, so that's, you know, a special case of main result. And I'll go a little bit about previous work about this and show this particular special case is not new. Okay, and you know what kind of applications we can think about. So you know, the first very kind of on the surface application of this is that you know, in the previous work we kind of used to this kind of ideas where, you know, something is Clifford, and then how far it is from being a Clifford. You basically can use it to define monotones for like resource states. And kind of the first application, you can define something similar to a dyadic monotone that kind of used here just based on polar expectations of states. But now you can take your unit tree, change it to this basis, and kind of, if you don't get integers, but you get some denominators, you can say, well, the higher power of denominator you have, the more kind of non-Clifford unitary ends up. Right. Okay. And we also offer some generalizations, right? So you can actually, instead of going from entries in QI, you can go to entries over higher degree cyclotomic fields. So we have kind of analytic proof for 2 to the m's root of unity, right? And we also go from 2m by 2 to the n Clifford unitaries to 2n prime by 2 to the n linear operators. And their corresponding result is, you say, instead of implementable by a Clifford unitary, that becomes implementable by a post-selective stabilizer circuit. So a quick reminder what a post-selective stabilizer circuit is. It can allocate zero states, apply Clifford unitaries, can apply post-selected measurements of poly observables, and can do the post-selected destructive poly measurements. And in addition, we offer some numerical techniques that allow you to basically use some mathematical packages to just, you know, go beyond this result, right? And we also use them to work out some examples like RIBITS, QDIS for dimensions 3 and 5, and also we can kind of go beyond the just powers of 2 cyclotomics, kind of go through some like, you know, 12th root of unity, like something like that. I mean, they all need to be divisible by 4 to have I, right? But other than that, you can kind of iterate through cyclotomics. Okay, so now I'm kind of wanna go through some key tools, right? How the proof works, right? And how the generalization works. And one of the key ideas here is this sort of general form of post-selective stabilizer circuit. It turns out that, you know, no matter what kind of stabilizer circuit you can come up with, the action of the circuit can be expressed by this very simple circuit, where essentially you have like a Clifford unitary, then you do a destructive measurement, then you allocate qubit, and you apply another Clifford unit tree. Right, so action of any post-selected stabilizer circuit is like that. And that's kind of based on previous work, where we actually have a more general result that applies not only to post-selected stabilizer circuits, but also for circuits that has a poly kind of normal measurements and poly's conditional parities of measurement outcomes. And to give you some intuition where this comes from, well, it kind of comes from this bipartite normal form of stabilizer state that kind of goes back in the day when people, you know, were studying like entanglement of stabilizer states. It's a pretty old paper from 2005, right? And so it turns out that any stabilizer state can be written as basically two Bell, k Bell states, and then just, you know, two Clifford unit trees according to some bipartition. And what you do, right, you kind of just go back and forth. You do, you take your post-selected circuit, look at the choice state that it produces, do this bipartite normal form, and that's kind of go back here, right? That, so, and essentially, like, because of the use of this Churge-Mikulski isomorphism, our proof reduces to a question about stabilizer states, right? So this, so the other key technical tool for our main results is understanding stabilizer states. But, you know, before I kind of proceed to this other technical tool, well, that's kind of a more general technical statement of a theorem, right? It's, I just took a screenshot from a paper, but here's this general form, right? And basically we say that any linear operator, right, over 2 to the nth degree cyclotomic with this technical trace condition implementable by post-select stabilizer circuit if in this special basis has entries in the ring of integers. And then, you know, you can actually kind of write down this Clifford's. And I guess another nice thing about this result is that in a way, like, this higher degree cyclotomics only come up as a global phase, right? So once you, so you can work, you know, in any higher degree cyclotomic field, you can check this condition, you know, an eighth root of unity 16, right? And it turns out that, well, you know, no matter where it holds, you kind of can just, this complication of higher degree cyclotomic field is just a global phase. Okay, so and where does this sort of comes from? Right, the key technical tool here is the theorem about the minimal vectors of n-qubit Barnes-Wall lattices over cyclotomic fields, and that's a generalization of this family of Barnes-Wall lattices that's studied kind of across many kind of fields of mathematics and appears in many places. And here, right, you say, okay, well, I'm gonna go like what about, I'll explain what's minimal vectors, you know, what those exactly the n-qubit Barnes-Wall lattices are, but the important thing is that those are stabilizer states up to the global phases, right? And kind of, you can kind of guess how the other kind of proofs and works, right? You kind of check that those basis states in this twisted, in this non-orthogonal basis are all integers, and they're kind of the shortest possible, and kind of use the Churge-Mikulski isomorphism and, you know, establish that your stabilizer state will just become a stabilizer operator. And I think this is, in itself, is a very neat description of stabilizer states because it's kind of, I don't know, if there are physicists in audience, right, physicists like this, like, kind of principle of minimal action, right, or, like, laws of nature is, like, go, it's like, you know, you evolve along the path that takes, like, the, say, minimal action or minimizes energy or something like that, right? And in a way, you know, this kind of similar description of stabilizer states where this is a, you know, it's some sort of extremal object of a lattice, right? It's the shortest vectors. Okay, well, so now let's go a little bit, talk about what those Barnes-Wall lattices are. And, you know, first technicality here is that well, we work with this object called Hermitian lattices, which is, you know, a generalization of a normal lattice. Well, here is what normal lattice, sometimes called an integer lattice. So you take some vectors and take all possible integer combinations of vectors, right? And this is, say, hexagonal lattice example in a plane, but kind of, you know, infinite points in this hexagonal pattern, that, right? And what you do to get your Hermitian lattices, you, instead of, you know, living in some vector space in a real space, you replace it with a real with number field. You live in now vector space over now with a base field that is a number field. You replace integers with a ring of integers of that number field. Okay, and you know, an example would be just to, yeah, again, take some basis to take all possible integer combinations of vectors in that basis. That gives you an example of a lattice. Okay, and that's basically how we can define the n-qubit Barnes-Wall lattice in a cyclotomic field. We one way to say, okay, we'll take that matrix B that we used, right? This is no, it's kind of rescale 0 and plus states, right? And just take all possible integer combinations over here. Or we just take like this, you know, tensor products of zeros and pluses and take all possible combinations of those, right? That's, okay, so now is kind of the next thing in my theorem statement is what's the minimal vector, right? And again, kind of going back to this hexagonal lattice, it has very nice minimal vectors that forms this kind of, right, they kind of go from a center of hexagon to its vertices, right? And, you know, those are exactly the shortest vectors in this lattice if that is an origin they go from. So we can all kind of define a concept of minimal vectors for Hermitian lattices. And so we take the normal Euclidean inner product to define the squared distance. But then what we minimize, we're going to minimize not just the size of the vector, but the sum. So this trace k of q is a trace in a trace function in a number field. And what it does is just sums over all possible embeddings of the number field into, in this case, reals, right? Because when we take Euclidean norm squared, it's already real, right? So it just remains to kind of look at the real embeddings here. Okay, right, so that's essentially the setup, right? Like you say, okay, that's our Hermitian lattice, right? And that's all the vectors that minimize this function, right? You can show that it's also always a rational number. So all the vectors that minimize the this function are actual stabilizer states, right? And that's kind of what we prove, right? And how is this related to some previous work? So the first time I think I found the kind of in this lattice appears in the quantum computing context, it's basically when quantum error correction via cause over GF4 is introduced by Karjalblank, Rains, Shore, and Sloan. In 1997, they already discussed the Barnes-Wall lattices. So they define them kind of slightly differently. And then there is this paper from 2001 that kind of constructs them as a tensor product structure. Because for a long time, you know, there was construction of this Barnes-Wall lattices was much more complicated. So this kind of insight that you can just take a tensor product, right, of the simple basis for one qubit, essentially, right? Make it into n qubit lattice. That's kind of what's from this paper. And they all consider sort of a real case, and they'll kind of work over this kind of slightly bigger ring of integers, zeta a there. However, they kind of don't, they show that Clifford groups are exactly the automorphism group. So let me comment what the automorphism group is. Right, so in case of this hexagonal lattice, it's kind of the orthogonal matrices that preserves the lattice, so it would be like rotation, like this rotating by 60 degrees and reflections. So and similarly for Hermitian lattice, you just define unitaries over number fields that preserves the lattice, and it turns out it must be finite group, right? And there they show that in this paper that they show that Clifford group for rebids and for complex Clifford group exactly that for the Barnes-Wall lattices. I guess one interesting aspect of that paper is that there is a pretty technical proof for 0, 2 and for real Clifford group, and the complex Clifford group is sort of left as an exercise to the reader. Also, kind of, I think this kind of property that the Clifford group acts sort of like transitively on the minimal vectors, right? That's kind of a key thing to understand, that minimal vectors are stabilizer things. So that's not shown in this paper. It's sort of known for what I call like classical Barnes-Wall lattices, which is closely related lattices, but kind of proper integral lattices to these ones. Right, and it's been like shown in this 1973 paper, but I guess to best of our knowledge, the sort of like Hermitian cases hasn't been treated kind of. And there also exist some tools that kind of, theoretical tools to extend to other base fields, right, which we kind of don't use. So our goal was for this paper to give like proofs that are self-contained for quantum computing community, right? So we kind of go from false principles, right, and we kind of crucially rely on stabilizer formalism and kind of also treat this, base fields at the same time, different cyclotomic fields. Okay. So now I'm going to go talk a little bit about the computational tools, right? So it turns out that, it's nice to have this analytic results, right? And But there are other groups we have, like Q-treats, like one or two Q-treats Clifford groups, and sometimes it's, or maybe you one day come up with some other finite group of gates that you just want to make sure that they're kind of easy to characterize, right? So, and they offer a heuristic how to come up with a lattice just starting from a group. So first, well, there is some creativity involved, obviously, like you cannot, it's not fully, automatic way of doing it, but so you need to look at your group carefully and decide over which field you're going to write it down. And then what you do, once you decided on the field, you take zero vector and just take an orbit of your group, acting on the zero vector, and just make a lattice by integer combinations of all the vectors in the orbit. And the kind of other interesting thing, there exist algorithms that work pretty well in practice to compute the automorphism group of Hermitian lattice, right? And just by construction of this lattice, your group will be a subgroup of automorphism group. Because, if you look at how this lattice is formed, right, you just took integer combination of everything in the orbit. So if you act on by a group element, you just permute, you just reorder the sum, right? So you'll stay with the same lattice, right? And so the only thing you're left is basically check if you get something bigger than the group you started with. And it turns out there's also like a bit faster algorithm to find the size of the group than actually computing the group. So if you start with a group that you know the size of, it's even faster. You can just, you compute the group size and just compare the two numbers. Okay, and in the spirit of that kind of more computational treatment of this question, we offer basically a notebook in Julia that exactly kind of does those computation, right? The kind of appendix in our paper shows, goes through these examples, right? The one and two Q-treats, Q-dit in dimension 5, right? Also it's kind of play. So the, you might ask, okay, what are the sort of examples and non-examples of that heuristic working? So it works, as you can see from also the proof for Clifford group, and you can just plug in different number fields for scalars, and you'll see like, just everything, all the cyclotomics of like 4 times m, well, up to 8 we checked, do something similar for a real Clifford group. Then you can ask yourself, okay, well, maybe I'm just interested in rational matrices that are inside Clifford group, and that's where you get a bigger group. So the lattice you get actually has a, by through that procedure from rational Clifford group, subgroup of Clifford group actually turns out to have a little bit more group element, kind of more things than its automorphism group. And again, it sort of works for Q-trees and Q-dit. And I guess the interesting thing about the Q-trees is that the tensor product structure doesn't hold anymore. Right, so for QDS, we basically could construct the you know, four-dimensional one, just taking a tensor product of two two-dimensional, and for real Clifford group, it's the same holds, but for Q-trees, the lattice that you get from just tensor product of these two three-dimensional lattices is actually a different lattice that you get if you just mono lattice that has an automorphous group for two Q-dit Clifford group. Okay, yeah, that's basically it, right? And you know, if you also use magma, then algorithm for this computation can be also found in magma, right? Basically, there is like a lot of out of the box functionality that's very easy to kind of plug in together to do those calculations. Okay, well, that's kind of that's it. This is the end of my talk. Okay. Yeah.
Questions?
More questions.
Here he goes.
Yep.
Let's just pass this back to you. I want it.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It's an if and only statement. So every stabilizer state times the. Okay, let me just go back to it. And, yeah, so that's basically, you know, this is orbit of a Clifford group, right? Every stabilizer state can be obtained as a Clifford times all zero state. And that was just my kind of shorthand notation for it. And this is like a Clifford group that's generated by this phase-adjusted Hadamard, right? And then you basically vary global phases, right?
Is it accurate to say that the stabilizer states
are precisely you evolve intersect the balance, or a global lattice, or is that? I mean, it is kind of a nice statement to make when you like over the just QI. Right, because they're like union ball kind of makes more sense,
yeah.
Right? Because you don't kind of, you know, just go to the definition of the minimal vector, right? So you see here in the definition of minimal vector, we kind of sum over all embedding of a real subfield, right? And in case of QI, that real subfield is just Q, so there's no sum, and so you can kind of nicely talk about union balls. But here it's kind of like, you know, several copies, so it's, you know, kind of slightly, I guess, yeah, I don't know, you need to kind of maybe adjust a little bit, like, what unit ball means.
I was just wondering, so you say, so there's this transitive group action of the automorphisms of the lattice. So I was just wondering if it, first of all, is it obvious or non-obvious or true or false whether this could be extended to say like distance transitive or like transitive on triangles or something like that?
You mean like a... So like two transitive action, like maybe on pairs of stabilizer states?
Yeah, like you have two vertices at a given vertex, like
yeah, so,
two other of a given distance, two others. Like.
So in some ways, like, so there is, it sort of covers it in a way, because, so it's kind of like you can reinterpret this result a little bit. And to think about, there are some special cases where some of this kind of more stronger, can think of it as a stronger case of transitivity. So say we have like this n prime is just one, right? So we have 2 by 2 to the n matrix. So what does it mean? We have, it's like it's an isometry, right? Or we can also think of that isometry is just a pair of stabilizer states. Right, so we just, you know, it's like image of zero is one stabilizer state and image of a plus is another stabilizer state. And this result basically tells you that there is this aquifer that will just, so this isometry can be completed to a full Clifford, right? And if you look at this picture here, in that case, what that means that, you know, you have like just one input. So this kind of, there's no measurement, right? So there's no destructive measurement. So you just kind of have like, it becomes isometry, and it tells you that there will exist a Clifford that extend kind of completes this isometry that just for two stabilizer states. And this basically means that you can just, there exists a Clifford that maps zero plus to the two stabilizer states you're interested in. So it's kind of a similar thing to say that, like, you know, if you have two stabilizer states, there's the inner product is the same as the inner product of a zero and plus, then there's a there's kind of two transitive action, right, on the pairs of stabilizer states. And you kind of, you know, and the similar results will be like for all isometries, like, you know, two to the, you know, four transitive, you know, and stuff like that. Right? As long as they kind of have the right, correct angles between them, mm-hmm. right? So the non-example would be, you know, say like Toffoli gate, right? It's it still maps certain stabilizer states to certain stabilizer states. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, maps computational basis states to computational basis states, but it's, you know, it's a not a Clifford. And exactly what captures that is that, you know, this basis is not orthogonal. So, you know, if you transform a Toffoli into this non-orthogonal basis, you will see that, you know, it has some denominators, and that kind of transitivity is not going to happen. Okay, and does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, can you say what thing can you build? Yeah.
I'll just talk about it. So I think one of the things you just said, I could do this or that.
Yeah.
I'll just this system is crazy. Okay. So I think one of the things, if I understood correctly, you were re-explaining the fact that any two stabilizer states can be brought into all zeros and then like a bunch of zeros and some pluses.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, as long as the
describing how that follows from your formalism or can be understood in this mm-hmm. way. So my question is, suppose I want to understand how, you know, what can six stabilizer states look like? I mean, is there a canonical form for six stabilizer states?
Yeah, I mean, this...
I mean,
yeah,
is that a question?
I think that's an open question, right?
Can you do three?
Yeah, that's... I don't know. I mean... Kind of the historically, kind of, I was trying to just first, I was actually, I only cared about like isometries and unitaries. And I was kind of trying to prove exactly kind of Gold shows this kind of transitivity in like few of them together, right? Like two and three, et cetera. And then things just didn't work out in the proof, so I went this choice state route.
Yeah.
So it's still open, like how to do like say.
Yeah, I think for three, like even proving that a state has stabilizer rank at least three, like there's not a, like, you know, not a mechanical way to do it as far as I know.
Yeah. So it's the kind of the non-powers of two are kind of still open.
Thanks. Send it back to you. Do you really want me to throw this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can like prove some results, start proving some results about like, you know, I mean, basically, like once stabilizer states are non-orthogonal, right? The inner product is related to the size of the intersection of the groups, right? So, maybe you can do some special cases, right? Like, because you already have two transitivities, so those are already brought to say like zero and plus, right? And but yeah, I tried that route and it wasn't nice.
So I have a question. You mentioned some more general construction or definition of Barnes-Wall lattices over other rings, like from the last maybe 10 years ago, like. What is the Barnes wall lattice by the general definition, not just the constructions for the real and complex ones? Are you just extending integers, or is it more than that?
Well, I mean, essentially, I mean, we kind of do this generalization, right, where we just change the integers, right? But the reference that I want to
refer. Or like extension of scalars, basically, or is there, or is it?
Yeah, more? That's. I mean, essentially, for Barnes, well, like, okay, well, let me just find this slide. Okay, so okay, this is the one I actually kind of forgot to mention. It's a very interesting work because it also talks about approximating vectors with Barnes-Wall lattice vectors, right, in L2 norm. And actually, if you just like start with this paper and look at the papers that cite this one, there's like a ton of work on various decoding questions for Barnes-Wall lattices, right? So that's maybe, and this is actually the reference if you wanna kind of see the connection between what people used to call Barnes-Wall lattices sort of before this Nyberg et al. Result is a tensor product structure. And essentially what you do, you take this Barnes-Wall lattice with Zi, and you just think of, you know, Gaussian integers as, you know, it's like you always can think of, you know, n-dimensional complex spaces to n-dimensional real space, right? And that's basically how you get the classical Barnes-Wall lattices from this. You essentially just start thinking about your spaces. And, you know, you can kind of write down the formula how the basis matrix will look like from this tensor product, which is like this block structure. I mean, it is like an appendix of another paper, the kind of explicit formula for classical Barnes-Wall lattice. But it's kind of interesting that they were like studied for so long, and you know, I guess Barnes-Wall is from like lattice introduction is in '60s, and because that's kind of people were interested in lattices with a lot of minimal vectors, and that's kind of was motivation how to construct them, and also some like extremal properties of lattices. But this kind of like really nice tensor product structure is just 2001, so. Took just 40 years to have a nice and simple definition.
Any questions from anybody online on Zoom?
Yes, I have a question. Can you hear me? Thank you for the talk. So I wonder, in the paper at the end, you mentioned about the basis change with respect to the BW lattice. It has an indication in the T count. And I wonder, does this canonical form that you present may help us find a tighter bound for T count, like, or what is exactly is the connection between this canonical form and the understanding of T count in circuit optimization, or if there is any connection?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think it's a good question. Like, I mean, so I guess the first kind of answer, if you look at, you know, the kind of first application, right? I mean, in a way, you know, this you can think of this power of denominator, right? I mean, for T gates, you need to work over, you know, A's root of unity here, right? And the power in the denominator will be like 1 plus A's root of unity, right? And that also gives you like lower bound on the T count of the unitary, right? Because essentially, like, proofs goes like that, right? For one T gate, that denominator is going to be just power will be one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it doesn't change if you apply like conjugated by Clifford, etc., right? Because mm-hmm. Clifford's just permute kind of integer stuff, right? And so if you had like n T gates, big n T gates, say the biggest power in that denominator will be like big n. Right. So that immediately establishes a lower bound on the T.
Oh,
right.
So you basically use this n, which is the denominator exponent, to indicate how many T count do you need.
Yeah. So I mean, it kind of gives you a lower bound. It's similar in spirit. Like, in a way, this is kind of an alternative to channel representations that was introduced by David Gossett, myself, and others, and kind of back in the day. And sort of like dyadic monotone here is like a sort of a channel version of a channel representation for states, right? And you kind of, you know, can replace the, you know, channel representation by this basis change and kind of do all the same things that's done for dyadic monotones in this paper, including that T count lower bound and can just do similar things for CCZ state, CCZs and control S. Yeah. Does it answer the question?
Or, yes. Yes.
Yeah, you had the second one about the canonical form, I guess, or.
Yes. Yeah. I want to know a little bit more about it.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess this canonical form, I think, is. I mean, it is purely for stabilizer circuits, right? So I think it's kind of an open question, like how you can extend this kind of results to kind of beyond stabilizer circuits. Yeah.
I mean. So for this canonical form, what would be the use case of this? Or do you, like, what's your conjecture? Like, how can we use it?
Well, okay, I mean, so one use case for this canonical form is that essentially that's kind of, you know, technical tool that lets us connect the result about stabilizer states being minimal vector of a lattice, right, to basically this basis change property of stabilizer operators, right? So that's, but that's a use case for the post-selected one. I mean, if you're interested in some other use cases, so there is this stabilizer circuit verification paper where we use it to basically find action of arbitrary stabilizer circuits. So you have algorithms there to, given any stabilizer circuit, right, with kind of normal measurements and Polis conditional parities, we can transform it into this and also find a map between measurement outcomes of both circuits. So that's kind of another use case, and then you can use it also to study some fault-tolerant properties of stabilizer circuits. There's some kind of other kind of follow-up work with by myself and Michael Beverland and Shilin Huang that kind of uses this machinery to kind of have a general definition of what does it mean for, what is the distance of stabilizer circuit and stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So but on that measure of non-Cliffordness, the thing you were just talking about. So, I mean, this is like one of these denominator exponent type measures, like the T count, I guess, which you would think is kind of like not really very smooth, right? Because you could probably have states that are very close to a stabilizer state that by this measure.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's smooth in a different metric, if you wish. It's not smooth in like.
No, I understand. Yeah. But okay, is there a way to get one that is smooth, that is out of these techniques, or somehow like?
I don't know how to get it smooth in like sort of in a normal complex or reals, right? It's.
Thanks.
It's kind of like, I mean, in a way, like, okay, I mean, yes, my. Sort of caricature for this comparison. Like, I mean, there is like a lot of nice smooth monotones, right? That kind of, you know, behave nicely with respect to perturbation of states, right? Like extent, and they come from some linear programs. You know, it's like if you think about like rational numbers, right? And you want complete rational numbers. There are two ways to complete rational numbers. Can I either complete them and get reals, or you can complete them using primes and get p-adics, right? So in a way, this is like a kind of a p-adic and versus real kind of the other ones, right? So this, I mean, I guess you can think of, like, you probably can actually kind of make it a little bit more formal and show that it's like with appropriately defining matrix distances in p-adic, mm-hmm. using p-adic metrics. It's probably going to be smooth in that sense.
Thanks.